From WNYC, this is The Sporkful.
Today on The Sporkful, we're opening the phone lines and taking your calls. Hi, who's this?
This is Josh in New Hampshire.
Hey, Josh, what can I do for you?
All right, I've got some advice for when you find yourself in this awkward situation of trying to choose a restaurant with people you don't really know that well, and restaurants keep getting thrown out, and people say they don't care where they go, but then they say no to every restaurant you suggest, and it turns into a sticky situation, especially if you don't know the people that well.
Right, that's true. This is a big issue, Josh. I'm glad you're raising this, and it's so maddening to try to figure out where to go to eat when you're with a big group, and like you said, like if it's your good friend, you can just say, no, I hate that place. I don't want to go there. I want to go to this place.
Right.
But when you're trying to be polite, if you don't know people so well, you know, everyone's trying to be diplomatic, but at the same time, no one wants to end up eating at a place where they don't want to eat.
Right. So you don't want to go into the conversation early. You want to kind of lay back. You want to see, because if someone has something in mind that they suggest early, you don't want to crush that early. Like, you don't want to say, no, that's a terrible restaurant, because you don't know the people well enough that maybe their favorite restaurant, their Uncle Tony may own it or whatever. And if you can avoid hurting someone's feeling early, you would definitely want to do that.
I like your strategy here, and I actually developed a similar strategy when I was on the student senate back in college for 1 year. And early on in the year, I kind of always wanted to shoot my mouth off and talk and tell everyone what I thought. But what I learned over the course of the year was that I actually could be more effective in persuading people to my point of view if I waited to talk until just the right moment in the debate. And I think what you're kind of saying, Josh, is that if you hang back in the conversation at first, oftentimes options that you don't like will get eliminated on their own or eliminated by other people.
Right.
And so you didn't have to speak up. And also that this is essentially a political negotiation. And as in politics, each person has a certain amount of capital to spend.
Right.
You can't be saying no, no, no all the time, because eventually everyone's going to decide that you're the one who's the jerk.
Exactly. So what you're going to do is you're going to let the conversation kind of get to that indecision moment, and then you're going to step in and save the day with this magic phrase. So you ready for this? This is what you're going to say. The magic phrase is, and you're going to say this very politely, but very decisively, you're going to use the phrase, someone told me about a place. So that shifts the responsibility away from everyone in the car. And now, if it's great, oh, what a great expert food friend that I have. And if it's not that good, then, I knew I shouldn't have listened to that guy. He's a jerk anyway.
Now, what happens if you walk in and the wait staff is like, hey, Josh, great to see you again? Then you're in trouble.
Yeah. You can't let the other people realize what's happening. So you have to be really smooth with it, or they're going to know that you're just trying to manipulate them.
Are you going to tell your friends about this appearance on The Sporkful, Josh?
Yes, I definitely will.
Okay. Because, I mean, you just lost it now. They're all going to be on the lookout
right.
For this.
I guess I better not tell them, or they're not going to listen to any of my suggestions on where to eat.
Yeah. It's a real problem for you.
This is a dilemma.
So, Josh, that's a great tip. I really appreciate that. I'm sure my listeners will thank you as well. So thanks so much for the call.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Well, eaters, we have lots more calls to get to in this show. A whoopie pie aficionado calls in today. We'll debate whether whoopie pies filled with cream cheese frosting are innovations or abominations. And when you bite into a whoopie pie, are some fillings actually supposed to be forced out the back? I mean, is it me or is that crazy talk? Well, we'll argue it. Plus, I'll offer a salsa consultation, and I'll issue a ruling on the dividing line between pizza and flatbread. We're doing the big work here. Stay with us. This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're taking your calls today on the show at 908-9-SPORK-9. Phone lines are open, and it looks like we have a call right now coming in from Micheline Maynard, who I actually know to be one of the world's leading authorities on the whoopie pie. She's gracing us with her presence. Hey, Mickey, how are you?
Hey, Dan, how are you?
Good. So, Mickey, where should we begin?
First of all, the whoopie pie is very simple but elegant. It's two cakes, generally devil's food, marshmallow cream filling, and that's it. Don't accept any substitutes. It's a classic Don't mess with it.
Now, you said marshmallow cream filling. Does that mean you oppose frosting in a whoopie pie?
Jeez. You know, I've seen whoopie pies with creme. I've seen whoopie pies with frosting. I've seen people try to put pudding in whoopie pies. No, 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 no. If it's not marshmallow filling, preferably marshmallow fluff, you don't really have a whoopie pie. You have something else, and I don't even know what to call it.
You wrote in the New York Times a few years back about whoopie pies when they were just becoming a real trend. And we were seeing all different kinds of cake and all different kinds of filling. Now, you're casting them all aside. You see no room for innovation in whoopie piedom?
You know, in fact, for my research in the New York Times, I think I tried 37 different whoopie pies. It isn't necessary. You know, I'm coming back to, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, form follows function here. And the function is something delicious. And the form is round with marshmallow filling.
Do you agree with me with respect to the form that one of the most fundamental criteria for a good whoopie pie is not necessarily the flavor of the cake or the style of the filling as much as it is the structural integrity of the entire thing, that when you bite into it, the filling should not be forced out the back? Is that...
Oh, I'm not going to go that far. You got to get a little filling on your fingers. I mean, it's not a perfect science here. We're not making hockey pucks. You know, we're not making those little bitty sandwiches that they serve in Denmark with the smoked salmon on them. We're making a whoopie pie, which is a treat. So it's not supposed to be perfect. In fact, it shouldn't be perfect. And it also isn't supposed to really be anything but devil's food. I don't know how many times I can say that. But
I feel like you're contradicting yourself now, Mickey, because on one hand, you're saying, throw caution to the wind, get some on your hands. You know, perfection's overrated. On the other hand, you're saying my way or the highway.
Well, my way to the perfect whoopie pie or the highway.
Where did whoopie pies come from? How did these things even come to be?
I mean, there is a debate over whether they come from Maine or Pennsylvania. But the whole idea is you don't go into a fancy French bakery and buy a whoopie pie. You go to a gas station or you buy one at a farmer's market. These are generally homemade treats that were put together. Actually, I think the derivation is that they were in lunch pails in Pennsylvania, and the miners would reach into their lunch pails and out would come this little cake, and they would go, whoopee. So you're not talking about a knife and fork here. You're talking about squeezing it together so you can get that bite, and it is going to ooze out the back. That's just what's going to happen.
Well, I have to respectfully disagree with you on that one, Mickey. I think that a whoopee pie is a sandwich at its core. At its core, it is a cake sandwich or a dessert sandwich. And I think that we need to apply the same criteria to the whoopie pie that we would apply to any other sandwich, which is that if you bite into it and fillings fall out the back, the sandwich has been engineered poorly.
Okay, well, but you're talking with sandwich with a multi-layer of ingredients.
I think what I just said applies to all sandwiches.
Even an ice cream sandwich on a 90-degree day, you think that that should retain its form as well?
Surely, yes. I think that there's a real art to eating an ice cream sandwich at just the right pace so that the ice cream is soft-ish as you bite into it. It shouldn't be hard to bite through, but firm enough to retain its structure. And I think if you receive it frozen solid and you eat it slowly at the right pace, you can have every bite tasty, soft ice cream without ever forcing any out the back. Of course, you're also a bit reliant on the manufacturer.
Right.
To give you an ice cream sandwich with soft cookies. If the cookies are hard and will require extreme bite force, well, then all bets are off. But that's not your fault. That's the maker's fault. Which brings me to my next question, which is, how soft should the cake in the whoopie pie be? I mean, I would think it should be pretty easy to bite through to pierce that cake.
Well, you're talking about two layers. So it better be moist. The perfect texture is almost a multi-dimensional connection between the cake, the softness of the cake, and the softness of the filling, so that you're not really sensing two different layers, or three, I suppose, in the case of a whoopie pie. almost one perfect melding of those ingredients. The worst thing would be to have a sort of a too dense middle and soft cake, and then you would just get a nasty surprise.
So you would be opposed to, let's say, like a red velvet cake whoopie pie with cream cheese frosting in the middle?
No. First of all, I hate red velvet cake. Red velvet is not a flavor.
I agree 100%.
Red velvet was a compromise. Because there wasn't chocolate, really. I've read Kim Severson's story about the derivation of red velvet cake. To me, red velvet cake is fake cake.
Yeah, it's like a victory of marketing over flavor.
And color. It's sort of pretty, but you want it to taste like chocolate, and it doesn't. It tastes like sort of flat Coca-Cola. Forget red velvet, forget cream cheese. I mean, I'm a little more flexible on the cream cheese thing, simply because I like cream cheese, but really, as a purist, I have to stick with my stand on marshmallow fluff.
How about a carrot cake, whoopie pie cake with cream cheese frosting in the middle, and before you close the sandwich, you sprinkle the cream cheese frosting with raisins?
Well, there are people that do that. That is a derivation. You know, so the most popular is obviously chocolate, but the second most popular is this pumpkin cream cheese connection. And then people are doing kind of a carrot cake whoopie pie. Not traditional, but some people like it. I'm not going to shun them because they do.
Well, thank you for not shunning me, Mickey.
I won't. I would never shun you, Dan.
Final question. What is your ideal ratio between whoopie pie cake and whoopie pie filling?
You can never have too much marshmallow fluff.
Well, Micheline Maynard, renowned whoopie pie expert, and tell me again your new position in Arizona State.
Director of the Reynolds Center for Business Journalism.
Okay, but mostly you do whoopie pies.
If I could do whoopie pies, that would be my career.
All right, thanks, Mickey.
Bye.
Coming up, more of your calls. Andy in Arizona makes homemade pizza, but his girlfriend says it's actually flatbread. I'll tell them who's right. Plus, George in Oakland says his friends can't handle his spicy salsa. Should he make milder salsa or find spicier friends? We'll discuss it. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman. Today on the show, we're taking your calls. And remember that you too can be a caller on The Sporkful. If you have a question, an innovation, a theory, or even like a debate that you need me to settle, well, I really, really want to hear from you. Drop me a line at dan@sporkful.com or give me a call, 908-9-SPORK-9. Now, let's get back to the phones. Hi, who's this?
This is Andy from Scottsdale, Arizona, and I've got a recipe with a question about terminology.
Okay, bring it.
So I like to call it a pizza. I get the pizza dough at the store, flatten it out like normal, take some minced garlic, which comes in a jar with some water in it, spread that over the flattened dough with my hands. I take some cambazola cheese, chop it up, sprinkle that over it. I like to use cambazola because I'm lactose intolerant, and the cheese is lactose-free, which is awesome. Then I cut up some Kalamata olives, sprinkle it on top of that, and throw it in the oven.
And what's the terminology issue?
Well, I think it's a pizza because I get pizza dough, I use a pizza tray, and I cut it into pizza slices with a pizza cutter. But my girlfriend and my friends all say that it's flatbread because a pizza has to have sauce. But I disagree because I think that the garlic that comes in the jar with a bit of water in it acts as the sauce for the pizza.
Interesting. But it's not a tomato sauce.
No, it's not. It's just garlic with the oily water in there.
This is a good one. And what's their argument? They say no sauce.
No sauce. And there's points in the dough. If I don't get enough cheese, which depending on how large of a block I buy, sometimes the cheese won't spread all the way across the dough, and so there's just bare spots of dough in some places if I don't have enough. And so that's the main argument that it's flatbread, because you can see the dough when it's not supposed to be the crust.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it does have cheese. Now, I know the type of minced garlic you're talking about. I don't think that it counts as a sauce. But really the question here is, are pizza and flatbread two separate categories? Or is, in fact, a pizza a type of flatbread?
Mm-hmm.
I think that a Neapolitan-style pizza, which is to say sort of any essentially flat pizza with anything on top, falls under the category of a flatbread. I think flatbread is a very vague, very generic term.
Yeah.
Almost any kind of flat bread with anything on it is a flatbread. It doesn't mean a whole lot when you call something a flatbread. It means something a little more specific when you call it a pizza.
Right.
Now, a Chicago-style pizza is not a flatbread. A Chicago-style pizza is actually a type of savory pie, I would argue. So I think that the answer to your question is that you and your friends are both right.
Yay!
This weekend, I want you to invite all your friends over, and I want you to tell them you're going to make pizza flatbread.
Okay.
And make a whole bunch for them, and have a celebration to celebrate the fact that you're all right.
Oh, I will do that. I did it on the Sporkful.
That's right. All right, Andy in Scottsdale, Arizona, thanks so much, buddy.
Thank you, Dan.
Hi, who's this?
Hi, this is George from Oakland, California.
George, what can I do for you?
I love making salsas. I've been making salsas since I was a kid. Long history, family history of salsa making, but a lot of my friends just can't handle spicy foods. So I find myself having to tone down the spice levels in my salsa or making them worse. So I wanted to know what your recommendations were for satisfying your friends who have heat sensitivity while still making the best salsa that I can make.
That's a tough one, George. And so, and am I right? So you're Mexican-American?
I am, yes.
Okay, and so you grew up, ever since you were a little kid, you're very comfortable with spicy foods.
Absolutely. It's a must.
So let me ask you this. When you make salsa the way you like it, tell me about how you make it.
See, well, I mean, the classic way that I generally would make a salsa would be roasting some tomatoes, maybe add some serrano or a jalapeno pepper, taste it, see how spicy it is, add as much as is basically my limit, and then go from there.
Do you feel like your friends are open to learning? Do you feel like they are willing pupils?
I find that people don't really know what they want, at least my friends. They'll say yes, and then they'll, if it's too spicy, they just won't eat it. They'll take a bite, and then they'll stop. So I feel like I have to find a happy medium where they'll eat it, and it's a little too spicy for them, but they'll keep eating it.
I mean, George, you are really up against a timeless quandary that artists of all stripes face, which is you know what you like, and you know how to do it to please yourself and your family and a specific target audience that I'm sure loves your salsa.
Absolutely.
But you want a wider audience.
Don't I have a moral obligation to increase their spice tolerance and get them to love the salsas?
Moral obligation? That might be a little strong. but I do think that it would be a worthwhile mission for you to undertake and beneficial
right.
for them as well as for you. And what have you tried so far to win them over besides just trying to force your salsa down their throats?
When I have friends over, that's when I start experimenting more with fruits, guacamoles with maybe slightly less spice. If I put in big chunks of jalapeno, sometimes they pick it out. Maybe that helps. Using chipotle in adobo sauce, I think, gives it like a smoky flavor and the illusion of spice without really being all that spicy. So that's one option as well.
Right. Well, you know, spicy food is very much about finding that sweet spot between pleasure and pain. Have you tried getting people to mix? So if you have one that's the way you like it and one that's mild, getting people to mix so that they can get themselves to their own breaking point?
I have not, actually. That's a good idea.
make some big bowls of salsa and give each person their own little bowl.
Right.
And a little spoon, and let them each make their own individual miniature bowl of salsa that they can tweak and mess with until they get it just right. And you're going to have to kind of push them to push themselves a little bit. But at a certain point, you know, you can't teach people things they don't want to learn.
Yeah. Oh, giving up salsa control, though, that'll be an effort.
That's hard for you to give up that level of control?
I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, what if they mess it up?
Well, you're in my plan, you're still keeping your patented, George's patented classic salsa remains its own thing.
So, right, they just control the spice level.
And I think you can also kind of, by letting go of the reins a little bit, making them feel a little more in control, you are empowering your friends, and you're also making an activity. So now it's not just you're serving food, now it's a game. And that's, I think, is something you can get people into. Like, it's, you know, it's George's homemade salsa party. I'm going to put out all these ingredients and everyone mix and match and learn and try these different flavors. And now it becomes an interactive event. Will you give that party a shot?
I will give it a shot.
All right, George in Oakland, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Before we wrap up, friends, I know a lot of folks really enjoyed the stuffing sandwich. That's the Thanksgiving leftover sandwich I talked about couple weeks ago. Well, there's another timely sandwich from my book that I thought I'd mention, and that's one called the Hanukkah Miracle Sandwich. As you may know, Hanukkah celebrates a time that the Jews in the ancient temple thought they only had enough oil to light the candles for one more night, and it turns out the oil lasted 8 miraculous nights. So it's traditional to eat oily fried foods at Hanukkah. And in the U.S., it's most often potato pancakes or latkes. But in Israel, their oily fried food of choice is actually donuts. So the Hanukkah miracle combines the two. You take a glazed yeast donut, slice it in half the long way, horizontally, and griddle it in butter so the insides get golden brown and buttery delicious. Then flip those two halves inside out so the grilled sides of the donut are on the outside. Spread sour cream on the bottom, applesauce on the top, and stick a potato pancake in the middle. You want the sour cream on the bottom closer to your tongue. You want to accentuate that flavor because you need that tart in there. Now, if that still sounds too sweet for you, do what we call an inside-out Hanukkah miracle sandwich. That's potato pancake on the top and bottom, donut in the middle. So, you're welcome and happy Hanukkah. Next week on The Sporkful, we're going to celebrate Christmas with a show about coquito. It's basically Puerto Rican eggnog. I'll go to a distillery in the Bronx where they make Puerto Rican moonshine, and we'll go to the regional championships of the International Coquito Federation. Their crest has a coconut in it. And also, I will drink for research. Remember, friends, that the absolute best way to keep in touch with me and The Sporkful is to sign up for our email newsletter. We won't bug you too often, and we'll never share your email address with anyone. We just want to drop you a line once in a while with some links and tidbits to make your life more delicious. To sign up, go to sporkful.com/newsletter. By the way, sporkful.com, also where you can see a picture of the Hanukkah miracle. This show is a production of WNYC and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani. Our web writers are Talia Ralph and Alight Trong. Special thanks to Chris Bannon. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.